Welcome to TNT's Hit Songs from Mars, where we unravel the stories behind some of pop's most unlikely hits.
From simple curiosities to songs that changed the world, we examine the socio-political and cultural factors that contributed to the success of these surprising outliers.
And the impact these songs had on society. I'm Tom Thompson.
And I'm Tyler Ralston. And together we're
TNT.
Hey, Ty. How's it going?
Hey, Tom. How are ya?
You're allowed to open your eyes now.
Okay. Another set of sunglasses.
That's So, I think you heard about the storm we had in Ontario and Quebec. Something happened with my eyewear. I can't figure out what's going on, but I guess it got tossed up in the air and mixed up a little bit.
Or maybe that was your brains you were referring to.
Yeah, probably.
Looks good. It's an improvement, actually.
Well, I have a whole bunch of exciting news.
All right, let's hear it.
If you let me share. First of all, I have one half day of work before I'm off for 3 months.
And all right.
I know it's nothing to you being a teacher because you're kind of off for that time anyways, but I have that little bit, so it's a little bit of a crazy rush. I have potentially three cool gigs this weekend.
Sweet.
One of which is on an island, Wolf Island, that we have to take a ferry to get to, where I've never been to. So that's kind of cool. That's with Graven. And we got another really cool gig at one of the bigger venues in town, Bronson Center, this time opening for 5440. Do you know that band?
I remember them, but I'm not too familiar with their stuff.
Yeah. They were pretty big in Canada for sure. Again, probably not that big in the States, I'm guessing. But of course, 5440.
That was our slogan.
Or fight. Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Right. It was all a bluff. They just wanted 49, and that's what they ended up with. So,
then the other funny thing that happened today was in the process of helping you out with a podcast episode. And again, I'm not going to mention exactly what I was doing, but I was picking up something. And in the process, I bought a backup pedal steel, which I've been looking for a while. And so I get to try it out, and I'm good friends with the owners of Spaceman Music. So they're just letting me try it out, and I haven't even tried it yet.
Were they big Bauhaus heads? Spaceman.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I doubt it. They're more like punk rock kind of. Well, one of the guys, Slow Tom, he goes by now. He's like a country singer, but he was in the band called Furnace Face, which I think we've already discussed.
Mentioned them. Yeah. And, well, yeah, we did.
Yeah. So a bunch of them co-own, it's all musician run basically. And it's kind of a staple in our community mostly for used instruments. And, it's always dangerous for me to go in there. I found something else really cool. There's people discovered that the amplifiers in the old school projectors can make a really cool guitar amp.
Okay. Interesting.
And so apparently like one of the best sounds you'll ever hear. So I discovered a small head of one of these. They're called Filmosound. I was very tempted to buy that as well, but I didn't, but I might. But the last thing I need is another amp, so we'll
yeah. Yeah, fair. Yeah, I know how that goes.
Yeah.
Well, I got a rare piece of good news here too. To get into town, I have to walk across a footbridge.
Oh.
And it's been closed since November. And so that suddenly, from being right in town, except I cross a footbridge, I'm like, you have to walk a good mile now all the way around the riverbed.
Okay.
And they fixed it and reopened it when word had it that they were just going to let it go. Cause I live on the rough part of town, and right across the river is a very wealthy part of town. And when they closed it for repairs, word got out that a lot of those wealthy people are like, keep it closed.
Oh, of course.
And I get it, because I know some troublesome characters go across. Yeah. Whereas they'd have to go all the way around. They wouldn't be in their neighborhood. But nevertheless, I'm happy they reopened it, because I can now walk to work again, whereas I couldn't for six, seven months. So
okay, that's interesting.
A rare piece of good news in this day and age.
Well, and it's funny, right? Because there's always those theories that, in rich neighborhoods, the roads are better. And there's just like it's kind of like a squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing where they talk to someone who knows the mayor or something. And you know what I mean? Like they know people in high places. So things happen faster in those communities.
I think what happened though, there was a, I mean, that definitely goes on around here. But what I think happened was there was some debate amongst the town elites. A lot of town elites really like the bridge and they enjoy it as recreational and just kind of a cool thing. It's been there for a better part of 100 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how many places have footbridges anymore that are actually, you know, functional? Mm-hmm. So I think it was, there must have been some internal debate because it normally would take a day to fix, but it took 6-7 months.
Yeah, that's fishy.
Well, it was, but then they reopened it. So I'm very pleased about that.
They've actually built a bunch of footbridges here in recent years for pedestrians and cyclists to cross our canal. The Rideau Canal, which is actually really cuts down on time if you're trying to, instead of having to go all the way around, as you say.
Yeah, they're very practical, good things to have. And encouraging, you know, bicycling, of course, is always a big plus.
For sure.
When COVID hit, I don't know about in Canada, but suddenly everyone rediscovered biking.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy a bike, I'm pretty sure, in pretty much the whole US for love or for money.
It was the same in Canada. I actually managed to get one, but it was literally the only reason I got, right at the beginning of the pandemic, I got a gravel bike. And I think the only reason it wasn't sold is because they had actually put it in the wrong place on their site.
Oh, you
so no one knew it was in stock.
You tripped into it.
Yeah, I did. I was kind of in the wrong category and somehow I saw it and I thought, oh, that's weird. But no, that's been a huge problem here. And, you know, cross-country skiing really took off in this area as well. But it's nice. That's one nice positive thing is that people are getting outside and enjoying nature more.
Well, one of the downsides was suddenly there's these herds of bikers in town that haven't ridden since they're like 5 years old or whatever, and they're a menace. Like this one woman, I mean, she looked like she was dressed like Lance Armstrong head to toe, and she was just riding along. She literally just fell over onto the street. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Reacquaint. Okay. You want to go for the full image. Okay, fine. But you know, reacquaint yourself with the techniques before you,
it's like they should put them on a stationary bike and do a test to see if they're roadworthy before they're allowed to get their license and graduate to the road.
Yeah. You have to get a bike license these days. Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah. All right, Tiso, what do you got for me today?
All right. I got something real special. Touching one. So here we go.
Touching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's just say it. Well, let's not try to preempt it. I'll just play it. So here we go.
All right. I took the sweet life and never knew I'd be. Interesting voice.
Great. Yeah. Great. Very nice voice. I spent my life exploring the subtle whoring that
costs too much to be free. Hey, lady, Oh my goodness. This is the weirdest song ever.
All right. So this is going to be interesting because, okay, A, the song was number one in Canada.
What year?
1982. Okay.
Wow.
And this is where it gets even, this is a very interesting song. And you might ask yourself, well, why is this an unexpected, you know, hit song from Mars? A lot of reasons. Okay, let's go ahead and just go through some of the facts.
I don't think you need to, some of them stand out right away, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's true. Okay, let's do the basics. The singer's name.
The subtle whoring. That was my favorite line.
That costs too much to be free. Okay, so here's the basics.
Okay.
Singer's name, Charlene.
Like just Charlene, like Madonna.
Yeah, except Charlene. Believe it or not, she was a staple at Motown Records. This is a Motown release. Mm. Okay.
Interesting.
This is what we'll call sort of kind of a double hit because it was released in 1977. Okay. Five years before it becomes a hit. So in 1977, it's released by Motown Records and it barely cracked the top 100. Barely cracked mm-hmm. it. So it's, and then a whole bunch of people did different versions of it. Charlene didn't write the song. She interpreted it. It was written by one of the most, I've got his name written, I think. Ron Miller. Ron Miller was the songwriter.
Okay.
One of their staple songwriters.
Staples, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But he wrote some of the some of Diana Ross, number one hit from Diana Ross. Stevie Wonder's something called like Once in a Lifetime or For Once in My Life, which you hear all the time. It appears in still on radio cycles and in movies and all sorts of stuff. So he wrote I've Never Been to Me. The song barely cracked the top 100, so obviously the record company was disappointed. Another woman did it for Motown, a grittier, bluesier version. Didn't go anywhere. The woman who did the grittier, bluesier version's name was Randy Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
I need to hear that version.
Hey lady, you lady, cursing at your life. You're a discontented mother and a regimented wife. I've no doubt you dream about the things you'll never do. But I wish someone had a talk to
But they didn't give up on the song. So in 1982, Motown re-releases it with two artists, Charlene's version and The Temptations did a man version of it.
Oh, yeah. Can't you see? Stole a woman. Listen to me. I don't want you to make the same mistake I made. Oh, no. I've been to paradise. I've even been there twice.
So these lyrics are exactly the same?
No, they're not the same.
Oh, they're not the same at all. Okay.
No, they reinterpret it as a male version.
Okay.
And it's basically, you know, I was what we'd call today a man whore, and it just got me nowhere, got me into big trouble. And if you get me a cup of coffee, mister, I'll tell you that you're making the same mistakes I do and not to do it. It's a little different.
So hold on a second here. Is there some kind of like religious lobby going on here? What's the deal with that?
We'll get there.
All right.
Let me continue with the basics, then we'll get to that.
Okay.
Because there's definitely you're onto something.
Okay.
Let's see. So the Temptations released this, as far as I could tell, on exactly the same day, January 1st, 1982. So Motown
that's so interesting. Motown, what a weird thing to do.
Motown was convinced that this song was going to hit, and they were right. And they were convinced that it was now the time to do it in 82, and they were right. And Charlene, the original recorder of it, and it went to number 3 in the United States, number 1 in Canada. And the only reason it didn't go to number 1, standing in its way, was, of course, Rick Springfield's Don't Talk to Strangers.
Oh.
Will prevent it from going to the top.
Okay.
And there's one more, obviously.
Don't Talk to Strangers. I don't remember that one. I'm sure I would know it.
Yeah, there's even some French in there, if I remember correctly.
Ooh, lovely. C'est bon ça.
Yeah, Rick Springfield's Don't Talk to Strangers. Don't talk to strangers, baby, don't you talk. And Ebony and Ivory kept it out of number 1.
Classic. That was a huge hit.
It was, but it, you never notice that one really doesn't have the staying power. It, you don't hear it that much, but yet for that year, it's That's all true. You heard.
That's true.
Oh, but let me tell you the story of how I discovered this was a hit song from Mars. About a year or so ago, I was with a friend in his basement. We were just yucking it up, drinking beers and stuff like that. And we were on an 80s kick. And so he said, pick the next song. And I said, Charlene, I've Never Been to Me. He goes, dude, that's 70s. I'm like, no, it's 80s.
Oh, okay.
And we started going back and forth. And then finally,
well, I'm impressed that your friend knew it was what it was, A, and then B, that it was actually released earlier.
Well, we were both adamant. And because he's like, look, I was living in North Dakota. I listened to the radio all the time when I was living there at that age. And I remember that song. It wasn't 82. And I said, well, I was living in X place and I listened to the radio and it was frickin' 82.
Yeah.
So we finally did what modern people do whenever there's a dispute. We finally got on the internet and it's like we were both right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we were both
so
right.
That's good. So no one, you didn't kill each other. That's good.
Yeah, we came to an amicable agreement that we were both right and we were both wrong.
Right.
And it's like I had no idea. So so that's what makes it interesting. Let me see if there's any other just
Well, there's a lot of things that make it interesting. Let's be straight here.
Oh, yes. And the fact that it goes number one in Canada, that's very telling of your culture. We'll come back to that.
I'm just seeing conspiracies everywhere here. So we'll see. We'll get there, I guess you say.
Conspiracies, you say.
Religious conspiracies.
Okay, let's go ahead and discuss that because that's obviously where we want to go. I think it's as simple as this. Looking at this 1970s and 1980s, you go first. Let's hear your conspiracy theory.
Well, no, go ahead.
Okay.
I want to hear what you have to say. I'm curious. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, I think what it was there, I mean, you know, decades don't just start and end on January 1st of whatever decade, you know, same with centuries and everything else. But curiously, in my mind anyway, the 80s kind of did. Okay.
Mm.
The 80s, there was a real shift that happened pretty much on January 1st, 1980, when things shifted away. Think about the 70s versus the 80s. There was such a divide. We go from thank God I'm a country boy in Rocky Mountain High to Material Girl in a very short amount of time. You know, sort of a back to nature. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not perfect, and there's disco and there's all sorts of other stuff going on. Yeah. But there seemed to be a real shift there, pretty much right on the dividing line. And I've got I've got evidence, and I'm going to play some of that evidence right now.
Oh my goodness, you're full of secrets today.
Okay, so this, hold on, I got to cue it up. Okay, so what we've got, I've got the number one song. That was the last number one song of the 1970s and the first number one song of the 1980s.
Okay. Love it.
And it captures, it. Let's just say it provides ammunition for my argument. Because if you listen to the chorus of this song that absolutely everybody knows, it talks about basically rejecting the stuff of the 70s and embracing the materialism of the 80s. So,
oh, interesting.
Let's listen.
Yes, I like pina colada.
I like pina coladas. I don't like health food. I like the 80s. I don't like the 70s. It's all right there, lined up perfectly.
Okay.
At the turn of the decade. So back to the song. What I think happened was 1977. It's still the excesses of the 70s and all of that. No one wants to hear about. I've you know, discontented housewives and all of that kind of stuff. But there was a real conservative backlash around that time. And in 1982, it's ripe. It's ripe for the song.
Okay.
And they hit pay dirt. It's a really odd song for the late 70s. I mean, what it seems to be is a fantasy of she says, you know, you're a discontented mother and a regimented wife and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then she lives this life of luxury and excess but is miserable. Mm-hmm. And then says, you know, unborn children and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, don't do what I did because what you're doing is the truth. And they literally use the word the truth.
Yeah.
Now, where this lines up politically, however you want to look at it, if you look at what we had in the U.S. in the 1970s was something called the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, which was an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, proposed amendment, it never passed, which was real pretty straightforward. You know, women have the same protections and obligations under the law.
Right.
But it had overwhelming support of both the Democratic and Republican parties. At the time, in the early 70s, it had the support of the next three presidents, the president, Richard Nixon, who was president in 1971, followed by Gerald Ford, followed by Jimmy Carter. All these people were in favor of it. Mm-hmm. A lot of support. And so, and then when an amendment, once it is passed, once it goes to the states, it has 7 years to get ratified, or it should theoretically die.
Okay.
So. Everyone just thought, okay, this is just going to wind its way through state legislatures and eventually the ERA will pass. Mm-hmm. However, come 1972 is when the Senate passed it, which means it goes to the states at that point. So it's got till, I think it was like March 1979. Come 1978, everyone who thought this was going to pass starts to realize that, this isn't going to fly because not enough states had ratified it. Some had ratified it and then had revoked the ratification. Hmm. And so a whole big mega debate emerged. And then there's that issue going on. But one of the issues within the issue was the homemaker, the housewife, whatever, however you want to refer to this person. A lot of these people rose up and it's like, I'm tired of being disrespected here, you know, just constantly scorned. And a woman named Phyllis Schlafly, I think her name was, she was very conservative and rallied the troops, so to speak. And a lot of people give her sort of single-handed credit or blame, however you want to look at it, with getting the ERA shot down. Hmm. She was a major conservative player for a very long time.
Okay.
And so at that point, going back to the song here, with labor in the House being disrespected, this song's speaking to that person. Mm-hmm. And so there's again that sort of conservative backlash of like, hey, we're valuable people too, and what we do is valuable. The song sort of does that. That's where it gets kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I guess the thing that seems really fishy to me is that now the two versions that came out, were they on the same label? Was that Motown?
I'd be willing to bet the Temptations were Motown.
Yeah. Oh, it must be.
Yeah.
I just think that's very weird. That's very counter to how the music business would work, that you would have two competing songs from your own label coming out at the same time. Like, to me, there was something like, we need to make this song a hit for some reason. You know what I mean? It was like, this goes beyond choosing, you know, what, like, okay, because record companies plan all this stuff out. You know, this record's going to come out in June, and then we're going to wait to release this other band's record till August or something like that. It's all planned out. So when you release two of the exact same song, that's weird, from the same label, basically competing with each other. That's very fishy to me. I've never heard of that happening before.
The one, I'm sure you're right, but the one thing that immediately pops to mind is that one's going straight to the RB people, one's going straight to soft rock.
Right.
And so maybe they thought, hey, we can get a double hit here.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's a good point that it's like they're going to completely different audiences and we're just going to dominate all the different groups with this song. That's fascinating.
Because there's really
what they were doing.
Yeah, there's really nothing R&B about the Charlene version. It's straight laced, you know, you're like, oh, nice gentle piano and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, I don't know, but it's like, we're going to make sure this song is a hit.
Yeah.
Because we think it's good and we think it can make it. And it did. They were right. Mm-hmm. Just the timing was off, hence making it a hit song from Mars because it was out of its temporal context. But then they waited and released it. Oh, well, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's so much of what we've been talking about so far is how literally in this case, 5 years later, something that tanked suddenly became a massive hit. So interesting.
All the way to number three. And then, of course, number one in Canada. And number six for the year-end list in Canada, by the way.
Okay.
So it's the number six song of the year. So amazing. It really caught hold there.
Now, would you say that, you know, speaking about, you know, obviously what you said about decades, like it's not, you know, not everything changes January 1st. But in this case, you're saying it did. In 1980, don't you think there was probably a similar thing between 69 and 1970, or do you think there was still a carryover a little bit
more
because 64 to 69 was such a incredibly disruptive time in everything, but in music in particular. I mean, I think if you look at what the, you know, if you look at the 1964 Beatles and the 1969 Beatles. Were the Beatles still around in 69? I think so. It's a very different thing. And it's amazing how much music in particular changed over that period. And this might sound really weird and mundane, but I have a theory about that. I think that the technology is part of this. And I think specifically the fuzz pedal was a huge part of this. It was basically the first... I'm not sure if we've talked about the fuzz pedal in our episodes before. Have I talked to you about this? Cause it's kind of fascinating.
No, go for it.
Okay. Well, the reason, the fuzz pedal was invented, and I don't have all the specifics, but, I can dig them up, but basically there was a country recording being done and, you know, as is normal with a bass guitar, you often will plug directly into the board where you don't necessarily play through an amp and then mic it. That's just how it's done. It's still done that way to this day. And some people will mic the amp and have it going direct. But what happened was the bass player went to do this solo and this gnarly fuzz sound came out. And at first they were like, what on earth is that garbage? Why is that so terrible? And then I think they listen back and they're like, you know, that's actually kind of cool.
Don't worry about me.
So then, of course, what happened was that they wanted to recreate this sound so that it could be reproducible, right? Because suddenly it was like we've got this whole new sound. So then I think the first people to put it into a pedal, like this is basically the first effects pedal ever, was the fuzz. And the very first one was the Gibson Maestro. I think FZ1, I believe, is the model number.
Z and to our most, American listeners.
Oh, I'm sorry. Apologies. It's just, I just swore basically. But then the person who really made this famous, of course, was Keith Richards with, Satisfaction. So that part, that was like one of the early, versions of fuzz. And I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think the idea was that he put it down with a fuzz because he pictured that as horn parts that they wanted to put into the song. But then when they recorded it, they were like, oh, this is so cool as is. And then they put it out. And then, of course, massive hit for the Stones. So then over the next few years, everyone was coming up with their own version of it. There was a British version, the Tone Bender. I can't remember what the company was exactly, but, so then suddenly everyone was playing these, and it's such an interesting time because it was such a big edge. Like everyone, especially people like Jimmy Page and Jimi Hendrix, they were early adopters of this stuff. And as soon as you start playing a fuzz pedal, that makes people crazy, right? Like that's a very disruptive kind of sound, you know, considering that a year ago it was like, she loves you. Yeah. You know, and suddenly you've got this really kind of gnarly sound. And I have a feeling that it kind of like brought something out in people, that it completely changed the course of music, where this kind of distorted sound was a desired effect. And I mean, that's a, you know, to this day, it's the most popular guitar effect for sure, is an overdriven or fuzzy sound. So, anyway, I went off on a tangent but I think, it's cool. I think that's what happened in the late '60s is the fuzz pedal really kind of changed everything.
Then you get the wah-wah shortly thereafter and the flanger, I believe. Interesting. Yeah. Regardless, what you said that, you know, between 64, 69, 70 was just so much went on musically, at least in rock, that it's just night and day. Yeah. I mean, it's lyrically everything. Yeah. Oh, but back to your original point about, you know, dividing line between 60s and 70s. Yeah, it's a pretty fair one in a lot of ways. You could look at it like this. The Beatles broke up. There's one. You had all those deaths in 70, 71. Mm-hmm. Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. And those are the big ones, just to name a few. And then the 70s, at least in rock, were basically, you know, refining those sounds that were developed from 64 to 70, say.
Mm-hmm.
Without your Jimi Hendrix, you don't get your Robin Trowers and, you know, your John McLaughlins and all that other stuff, all those other directions that those doors opened.
I'm not sure the division is so clean, the 60s into the 70s, where it's an immediate change. I do think it happens at around 72. Things really change a lot about the way music is. And the reason I know that is because we kind of have this game. So many of my friends are turning 50, including myself. I'm dating myself right now out to the world. And what the kind of game that we've been playing is that we play all the hit songs from that person's birth year. And so now we've been through 77. I was 70 and another friend of mine was 71 and another friend of mine recently turned 50. So we were looking at 72 and 70 was pretty good. 71 was awesome. I can't exactly remember why, but all of the songs from 71 were pretty awesome. And then I have to say 72 really took a downturn. It's pretty bad. It suddenly becomes bloated prog rock kind of thing. So maybe it wasn't so much of a change from 69 to 70. It was more that 71 to 72 where things got really kind of bloated.
And you could make the same argument for this 50s into the 60s when everything's kind of, you know, rockabilly-ish, Elvis, this, that, and the other thing until the Beatles come up. And that Chad blew the whole thing open. And let's go to the 80s again. The decades don't just snap change, but when I was looking up the hit songs for 82 for Charlene, what I noticed is I accidentally went to 83 and I'm like, where the hell's the song? I looked everywhere. How could a number 3 song not be here? I'm like, oh, I'm in the wrong year, numbnuts. So what I realized is like, oh, wow, the new wave era hit around 83 because there's really none of, like, you know, our house, which we've discussed, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. It hit about the next year. 82, in a sense, was like the, you know, the final years of the 70s in some ways.
Well, this is interesting. Maybe that division is always at the second.
It happens on
decade.
The two. It happens on the two. All right, we'll put the theory to the test in future yeah. podcast.
I like that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Anyway, what you were saying? Oh, okay. I was going to ask you a question. Do you know what your birth song is? The number one song when you were born.
I don't. I did at some point. Someone sent it to me. I think on one of my birthdays, and I don't remember what it was, but my recollection is it was not very cool.
I don't know what I'm up against. I don't know what it's all about. I got so much to think about.
What about you? Do you know yours?
I do, and it's American Pie.
Okay.
Which I can live with that.
Yeah, it's not my favorite, but it's not horrible.
It's a memorable, at least. I mean, it's an all-time classic. I mean, that they'll play that song as long as songs are played.
It's kind of I would say it's kind of a weak melody.
Okay, explain.
I don't know. I just think it's not a very interesting melody. There's just nothing, you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, feels like rote. I don't know.
Interesting. No, I never considered that. I guess, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's the greatest song ever. I dig it. It's, you know, it's a nice long one. It works for as long as it is. I think it's the imagery that really comes to life in that one. The different images, lyrical images that Don McLean conjures up there.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah, like the marching band not yielding to the football team is pretty funny.
Yeah, that's true. that's true.
The halftime air was sweet perfume while the sergeants played a marching tune.
So, okay, so I have, back to the song, I have a question for you.
Go for it.
What do you think the lyric, "but I've never been to me," means?
That's a good question. Yeah, I've been
to paradise, never been to me. That's so interesting. It's like the most recurring lyric in the song. I was just curious what your thoughts are.
Has never been to her true self. That's how I would see that.
That makes sense.
Okay, now we're on to something here. This is an interesting song in a lot of ways, because again, 1950s, there was sort of the beginning of a lot of modern feminist movements of, you know, being at home with the husband and all of that and being very unsatisfied. Mm-hmm. Apparently a lot of women didn't want to acknowledge it. The idea was to put your best foot forward. Everything's just peachy keen and hunky dory. Mm-hmm. But yet, as women would talk to each other, they started to refer to this as the problem, the problem that has no name. Everything's fine. Everything's the way it was supposed to be, but I'm not happy.
Mm-hmm.
So the song acknowledges that that's an issue.
Yeah.
The very beginning, it says, "Hey, lady, you lady, cursing at your life. You're a regimented mother and a discontented wife." I mean, that's point blank.
Yeah.
But then the song goes on to say, "Hey, you're miserable, but the life of paradise and luxury and sipping champagne on yachts and going to the Isle of Greece," wherever the Isle of Greece is. Last time I checked, Greece is a peninsula, just to set the record straight. I mean, Isles of Greece I could get, Isle of Crete, but not, anyway, you get my point.
I do.
Yes. Okay. I had to fact check on that one there. It's her fantasy. She can make Greece an island if she wants to. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so the idea here that, yeah, she's living this life of, you know, this life in the fast lane, sipping champagne, being undressed by kings, so on and so forth. And yet she's saying, this is worse than what your misery is.
That's what's confusing about this song, because I'm not really sure what the message is. It seems to play on both sides of that.
But I think I don't think it was intended. It stumbles onto a very big question, mm-hmm, of security, having a home and a family and things like that, versus life of adventure and the ultimate incompatibility of the two. Mm. You're going to have to give something up.
Can't you have a little bit of both?
Well, that's just, yeah, of course. And yeah. I think, and actually, I'd be willing to bet in both our cases, we do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure a lot of people do, but yet there's still going to be something that has to be given up, a certain amount of freedom, this, that, and the other thing. So, I mean, it's weird. It's maybe the lyrics aren't the most thought out things in the world, but it's like, you're miserable, but living this partying life is far more miserable because it's a lie. your misery is true, and true misery is better than false misery.
Yeah. But then that begs the question. So they've clearly wanted to make the song a hit. They've put out two versions at the exact same time. They have some reason for this. I mean, it could be they just wanted the songwriter to make money. That's a very straightforward thing. But I guess
they
if
had
it
faith
was
in the song.
Right. But if there was something more kind of sinister about it, it's hard to even know what the message is exactly. Kudos. It's such an interesting song.
It is. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense in that sense, but I think it raises unintentionally perhaps, but it raises a bigger question about modern life.
Yeah.
You know, is it a question of choosing your misery if you have the choice?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a peasant on the hillside in Mexico isn't, you know, doing that. That doesn't have that kind of choice.
Yeah.
It's a rich person's problem, these kinds of choices.
Yeah, and yet, yeah, it's true. And yet I have this theory. I feel like I maybe already talked about it in a podcast. You can just bleep out and put in a song in for the next 2 minutes if that's the case. But I have this theory about that you have to be close enough to the struggle of putting food on the table for life to be kind of meaningful. So not to say, obviously, being comfortable and having a roof over your head and not worrying about finances, and if you lose your job, having a bit of a cushion, that's a very privileged place to be. But I do think there's something about the being a little bit close to the struggle where you appreciate things more because you realize things could go down the toilet at any moment, instead of being in a very cushy place where you, no matter what you do, you're going to end up, you know, comfortable. So yeah, that's just the theory I have. I mean, to take it to the next step, I think when people are close to the struggle, you know, going out for a meal is a huge thing for them. They've been saving up for it all month or for a couple months or whatever. And you know what? They're going to have a good time. And it's great to be around those people because they've decided that they really want to live life to the fullest for that one night because they can't afford to do a lot. And it's, I don't know. It's very, it's nice to be around that.
It used to be like in prior to the modern era where there's, you know, this hyperabundance of stuff, you know, things like meat was a rare commodity. Hence, you have, you know, big meat dishes at holidays because it was like maybe the one time a year, and it coincides with the end of the harvest season where either that animal's becoming sausage or they're going to hope it gets through the winter.
Exactly.
Because it's going to be draining resources as well.
Yeah.
Just off the top of my head, the Norsemen, or, you know, Vikings, you know, there is a difference, but just for the sake of argument, the Vikings, every year, again, they didn't have a whole lot. Again, to own a cow was extreme privilege. That mm-hmm. You didn't slaughter your cows. That would be a rare thing. goats and sheep, sure. And of course, help yourself to, you know, Christians, cows, goats and sheep, no problem there. As they went, and I mean, the Viking period was the era of the plunder. It was about a 200-year period of which this group is mostly remembered. Yeah. But again, back in Norway, the king, who wasn't a king by everyday standards, he was more of like a chief of chiefs. Every year he was expected to have a feast where they would, you know, have lots of meat, lots of mead, just party hardy. And during that time, the king would resolve differences, you know, give to less fortunate. I mean, just kind of ease the tension of the year. Mm-hmm. But most of the time they didn't have a whole lot.
Yeah.
They were just seen as these very poor, weird, very pale people that periodically came into the Mediterranean to trade not much of anything and hope they could get something for it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, yeah, this, if you're close to the struggle, there's, yeah, you're living life by default. Although
that's it.
It could be a pretty tense one, pretty nerve wracking one.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be too close to the struggle, because that's just all, constant stress of you know, never knowing if you're going to make your rent or whatever.
Yeah, that life's pretty tough then, for sure. No doubt about that.
Well, it's interesting, and to kind of take this to a personal level with my mother was a homemaker. She started off as a teacher, and then she had kids, and then she stayed home and took care of us. And I'm very appreciative of that, but certainly there was a whole part of life that she missed out on as a result of that, and being dependent on her husband's wage. You know what I mean? That it's a very weird relationship to be in, to not have your own money, even though you're doing a very valuable job in the home, you know?
Well, I remember, I'll never forget, your mom, in fact, very articulately argues like, no, that is worth money. That is worth money.
Absolutely.
It's not acknowledged.
Yeah.
Didn't she read to you at the breakfast table, novels and stuff?
Yeah, I think that was one of the coolest things she did, especially for me, because I wasn't really a reader. My sisters were just naturally readers. They read all the time, but she took it upon herself to get these classics into my brain at any cost. And so we would literally, while I was eating breakfast, sometimes it was 4 minutes, she would read a passage from, you know, a Dickens novel or Treasure Island. I think that was my favorite. We got through a lot of books amazingly in those little, you know, snippet. And then, you know, it was kind of funny because half the time I would be just like out the door, like, okay, I want to get out here. I want to go to school. But every once in a while I'd be like kind of, you know, holding back a little bit and be like, can we have a little bit more?
Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think it was Treasure Island that was usually the one where I was lollygagging a little bit.
Treasure Island that's one, if you grab it, it's like next thing you know, you finished it without having gotten up.
It's a terrific read, yeah.
But okay, you've raised a very interesting point here. Again, the stereotypical housewife is scorned, and this, the stereotypical image of all I do around here is cook and clean. Mm-hmm. So it's scorned. And then this song is kind of speaking to those people. Mm-hmm. Where Miller got the idea to do that, I have no clue. He thought he was tapping into something. But okay, let's fast forward now. Okay, so women get out of the house, they have their careers and things like that. Let's fast forward to 2021. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the United States, 2022, sorry. well, no, 2021's fine. That actually worked. I don't know if in Canada you're experiencing the same thing as we are. Things are, you know, different setup to a certain degree. We're experiencing something called the Great Resignation right now. Are you familiar with that? Or have you heard of that?
No, I don't know what that means.
Okay. What's going on is, you know, one of the big issues in the U.S. right now is that, okay, COVID is sort of behind us, whether it is or not, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but people were expected, all right, they're going to come, you know, screaming back to their jobs. Everything's going to roll back to normal. But then what has happened is a lot of people are not coming back to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
yes. Sorry, I have heard about this.
Then. Okay.
Yeah, and that is happening in Canada as well.
I figured it because it couldn't be. It's certainly mostly with the middle class, you know, what they appropriately refer to as the email class.
Right.
Work from home people. A number of things happened. And one group of these is mothers and to a certain extent fathers who, you know, after they were home with their kids, you know, what they discovered is a couple things. Like, first of all, I get all my work done in about 3 hours, and then I can spend the time with my kids. I don't need to sit in the office for 9 hours.
Yeah.
Don't need to commute. And then they realize another thing that seems to be happening. It's like, you know what? I hate my job. You know what else? I like being with my kids.
Right.
And you know what else? My kids like it when I'm here.
Yeah.
And you know what else? My paycheck just goes to daycare.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And so I'm not going back.
Yeah.
And this is happening. Yeah. I saw an article just the other day with Apple where even high ranking employees are just, nah, I'm not coming back. Because I guess they basically called out employees still working from home. It's like, time to come back to the office. And a number of them like, I quit.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a high-ranking person at Apple can probably find a job anywhere.
Or, something else online.
Or start their own company or whatever, you know.
Or has enough socked away that they can kind of coast on that for a while, although that's increasingly not an option as the market has to come down. It's coming. Mm-hmm. But we've come full circle. You know, if so many women wanted to get out of the house, and rightly so, this isn't a critique, but then it's like, you know what? That paradise wasn't always what I thought it was to be working out in the world. Not everyone, obviously. Yeah. I'd rather be home with my kids. I've done the work-a-day thing, and now I'm ready to be a mom, and I'm going to do it on my own terms. It's a little different. It's a choice.
Yeah.
Again, middle class, working class mothers don't have this option, but the email class does. And it's an interesting thing going on that I think we haven't quite wrapped our minds around yet. So, you know, have these people now been to me is another question.
Yeah. Yeah. What I find interesting about it is that you would think through the process of what the person is describing, they would have been to me. Why wouldn't they have been to me? Because they were actually exploring their instincts or whatever, while others, you know, the other women were stuck in the home or something. Like, why wouldn't you have found me? That's interesting.
Well, the song strikes me, the whole thing's it strikes me as this fantasy. It's like, I'm miserable, but if I were to live this fantasy, it would be great, but I'd be far more miserable. So I'm just going to, my own existence is justified because I know that I'm doing the right thing. It's a strange song. If you start to actually look into the lyrics, I mean that almost melodramatic, and the same man you fought with this morning, the same one you're going to make love to tonight. That's truth. That's love. I mean,
you know what's funny? When you take that tone, it's exactly the same tone that your sister takes when she's making that kind of a point. It's very funny.
That's scary. But then they lay it on thick at the end of the song. The subtle whoring that costs too much to be free.
Yeah.
Laying it on thick.
Yeah.
There's serious judgment at that point. Now, on the other hand, looking at it from my male perspective, I dragged out that quote unquote paradise life as long as I could till I was about 40 or so.
Okay.
But I could also see that it was going to run out.
Yeah.
The options of a 50-year-old, drinking and partying and, chasing after women and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, there's an,
it's pretty unsavory.
Yeah. Creepy old man. Yeah. So there's an expiration date on all of that. So I guess if you wanted to drag out that life past its pull date, you could run into some real problems.
Yeah, it's true.
But again, back to the original question, is it possible to have a fulfilling life it, you know, not give something up, you know, in terms of safety, security in the home and adventure and all of that. And that's a very tough question.
Well, you know, and I'm pretty sure I've said this before, but it's to me, it's like I always try and bring it back to music, but I'm actually not. But again, it's like the same thing as a perfect song. A perfect song has enough security that you understand what's going on with little adventures that you don't. It's, you know, it's like the song is the metaphor for life. This is what we're learning, Ty. This is why this is so monumental, what we're doing here.
Monumental. Yeah. Good one.
But I had another point, and now take this with a grain of salt because, most of my friends are musicians and artists, etc. But what's interesting is that a lot of the time, the men I know would rather be at home with the kids than in the workforce. And I don't know if that's just because I hang out with a lot of artsy types. Do you find that that's something you're finding?
I think that's a very individual thing.
Okay.
As luck would have it, I'm a 10-minute walk from work, and my days as a professor as such, I can come and go and things like that. I end up doing exactly that. And it's exhausting, but it's also, you know, I never lose sight of, like, there's, you know, when I'm out, I got a kid who really likes to walk, and we walk for miles at a time and things like that, and on the woods and things. Like, there's nothing I'd rather be doing.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah. So it's there. It's exhausting though. It really is that I don't get a lot of breaks, but that's, you know, that's life. It's a privileged, I don't get a lot of breaks.
Well, and it's also life when you have a fairly young child. That will change, of course.
Yeah.
Soon enough, you'll be begging for those moments.
Yeah, I never thought of that, but that's probably true.
It's coming. Not for a while, but.
It's like, get out of here, Dad. I don't want anything to do with any of that.
And then they come out of it and then they appreciate you again. I think that's there's a cycle there that all kids go through. The teenage years, I think, are, you know, they can get pretty scornful of their parents, but they come around.
But we can just, you know, kind of wrap it up here. So how does something like Charlene, I've Never Been to Me hold up in 2022?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I can't recall in recent memory hearing a song that had such a strange conflicting message to it, which I love because I love ambiguity. It's one of my favorite things, and not knowing what exactly something means. I love that. So I find it very intriguing, and I don't know. It's fascinating. I can't think of another song that has such a strange, ambiguous message to it. There must be many, but I can't think of any right now.
How do you explain the fact that it hit number one in Canada? Think 1982. I mean,
Paola.
What would be a what is it?
Paola.
So Canadian DJs were corruptible to Motown Records.
Everyone was corrupt at that time. They were all taking money to be, I'm just joking. I don't think that's why. I don't really have an explanation for it. And I think, which means you've picked on a great song here.
And of course you just might like the song and not be concerned about the lyrics. Yeah. I mean, really,
I wouldn't really say it's nice that voice. Strong though, as a musically. It's okay.
It's yeah. I mean, it's a potent song, and I mean, you don't, on top 40 radio, you don't hear about the subtle whoring and unborn babies and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's an interesting question right there. Would it be banned? Like, you would think saying the word whore in a song would be banned at that time.
I mean, interesting point. It never got through the censors.
Yeah.
Or yeah, the top 40 type. Yeah. It wasn't blurted, you know, blobbed out or anything. I guess it's a woman calling herself a whore. So it's okay.
I mean, usually these censorship things are not, they're not based on reason. They're just based on, these are seven words you can't say. And surprisingly, I guess whore is is not one of those.
Let me ask you a question here. We've known each other for decades. I feel like I can ask a rather personal question here.
Sure.
Have you ever been to you?
I mean, I feel like I have. I feel like I've been to me.
Been to you? Okay.
That's I don't know. Good. Have you been to you?
I mean, I've been to paradise.
Which is better, you or paradise?
Is there a difference, is the question one needs to ask for this question. Thanks for tuning in to the 8th and final episode of Season 1 of TNT's Hit Songs from Mars. Stay tuned for Season 2, which is making its way to Earth as we speak. To ensure that you get these dynamite new episodes as soon as they become available, please subscribe or follow us.
While you're at it, if you could give us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, that would really help us out.
For a complete list of songs you heard in this episode, visit us at hsfm.buzzsprout.com. We hope you'll support the artists we featured by purchasing their music.
We would like to thank The Reverb Syndicate for providing the theme song for our podcast. They have an extensive catalog of tunes just as rockin' as the one you hear here.
Hear, hear.
You can find them at thereverbsyndicate.ca and on Facebook, SoundCloud, and Bandcamp, which typically pays artists the most. We would also like to thank Eric Minot for designing our podcast icon. You can find his design and illustration work on Instagram at MinoGraphics. That's MinoGraphics. You can connect with us on Twitter at Songs from Mars and at hsfm.buzzsprout.com.
Feel free to disagree, praise, correct, and chastise us.
We would also love to hear your idea of a hit song from Mars and why you think it fits the mold. Even better, if you felt like recording a voice memo and sending it our way, you can email us at hitsongsfrommars@gmail.com. We may even feature it on the show. Until next time, Earthlings.